Caribbean African Language and Literature next on Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Literary scholar Maureen Warner Lewis of the University of the West Indies is here now to discuss her new book about Caribbean African languages and culture.
Also, as a linguist and as a literary person, I look at in the Caribbean at the survival of proverbs and certain idiomatic expressions, certain ways of speaking, certain speech conventions that we observe, certain ways of what we call throwing words at people, speaking indirectly. And these are of all speech aspects of speech culture that are very much bound up with African cultural and speech behavior.
Maureen Warner Lewis of the University of the West Indies. She'll be back in just a moment to talk about Caribbean African languages and literature. Partial support for this program comes from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center. For scholars and popular audiences, the languages and literature of the Caribbean have only recently moved beyond the domain of anthropology. Likewise, much scholarship of only a generation ago focused mainly on the economic dimensions of the slave trade, while the linguistic and literary traffic between Africa and the Caribbean was frequently overlooked. But today, thanks to the work of scholars such as Maureen Warner Lewis, that picture is changing. Maureen Warner Lewis teaches at the University of the West Indies and is the author of numerous works on Caribbean African language and literary culture. Her new book explores Caribbean African languages and their cultural importance. Scheduled for publication by the University of Alabama Press, the book is tentatively entitled From Memory to Mother Tongue. In it, Maureen Warner Lewis examines West African languages such as Kikongo, Yoruba, Hausa, and Fon as the metaphorical and thematic sources of present-day Caribbean speech. She notes that because of the oral nature of traditional African literature, much of the linguistic heritage of Africa in the Caribbean has been lost as memories of African descendants fade and speakers of ancestral languages die. But she also finds a preservable body of evidence in African proverbs, folk tales, riddles, prayers, chants, and workaday songs that survived the passage to the New World. I asked Maureen Warner Lewis to begin her discussion by reflecting on the perils and rewards of working with sources that are primarily oral rather than documentary.
The way that I look at it, the things that are written in books are things that just as easily could have been spoken. It's just that the medium through which we come to know them is through a written source. Uh-huh. But before they were written, they were thought and they were probably said by people and then transmitted into writing. And that's how we come to know them. So that because something is not written, we should not disrespect it.
Is this a fairly recent phenomenon in scholarship, Maureen, for people to take seriously the whole notion of orality and that which is not written down as something that is worthy of scholarly interest?
Yes, I think it's of a recent development in historiography, for instance, and particularly related to the study of African history. And scholars have been spending a lot of time debating on how useful African oral sources are.
What kinds of things do you look at, Maureen Warner Lewis? I would guess songs and prayers and chants and the kind of exchange that goes on in the everyday medium of work and the home, that kind
yes,
of thing.
Yes, well, I began by asking people, I began in the 1960s, by asking people on islands in the Caribbean, Trinidad, for instance. I've done it also in Jamaica and in Cuba, by asking people if they can remember any bits of African language whatsoever. And this has turned up statements that have to do with everyday life. Go and bring the pot, put the pot, bring my tobacco pipe, things like that. Uh-huh. A lot of instructions, greetings, because in African culture, greetings are very important. children are taught from an early age to greet people properly. That is to say, good morning, good afternoon. Every hour of the day, there's a particular greeting for that time of the day. And greetings in Africa go on for a particularly extended period of time.
Is there a reason? Let me stop you on that. Is there a reason for that? Is that something cultural or linguistic? What's
no,
at work
I think
here?
I think it's cultural. Just so as the Japanese have their nods and, you know, degrees of inclination of the head and so on. Mm-hmm. In Africa, a lot of attention is paid to greeting. Children would be reprimanded if they don't greet elders properly and things like that. It is very important to ask, when you're greeting people, to ask not only after their own health, but also the health of their family. Uh-huh. You have to, that sense of community is very strongly enunciated in the greeting etiquette.
What kinds of languages do you work with, Maureen? You mentioned African languages. Are we talking about a dozen, 100? how many?
Well, for my purposes, maybe about 6. The evidence from Trinidad suggested that the Yoruba language, which is spoken today in southwest Nigeria, in parts of what used to be called Dahomey and now is called Benin, and also parts of Togo. That language, Yoruba language, was the strongest that had been retained. The next strongest is Kikongo, which is from today's Republic of Congo in Central Africa, Zaire, and Northern Angola. Mm-hmm. But there is also Hausa, which is spoken across the virtually the whole savanna belt of West Africa. There is Fon, which comes from what used to be Dahomey, now Benin. There is Arabic, snatches of Arabic, because by the 19th century, a fair amount of the savanna belt of West Africa had become Islamicized.
Now, how did these languages travel in space and time? It's a very big order, Maureen, but I want you to reflect on what happened to them as they moved from African shores to Caribbean shores.
Well, of course, these languages came across the Atlantic with the transatlantic slavery. And then they were supplemented when, in the second half of the 19th century, after the British, for instance, had abolished the slave trade in 1807, and after slavery in the Caribbean had been abolished in the English-speaking islands in between 1834 and 1838, even after that, you see, slaves were still being collected because the slave trade was an economic system. And it was not easy to wind down this system. A whole series a whole economic order had been established in Africa on the basis of slavery. And it was not easy to discontinue it. The Europeans didn't want it discontinued. Their slavery was still going on in the United States, in Cuba, and in Brazil. And these are very large, slave markets.
And you would have an analogously complicated picture when it comes to language.
So that after, in the second half of the 19th century, when the trade was still going on, people were still being brought to this part of the world, even though in the British Islands they were now being hired no longer as slaves, but as indentured laborers. So that this new wave that came from the 1840s, even until the 1870s, they continued and they bolstered the use of African languages in the Caribbean. Because, you know, the orthodoxy has been that African languages have died out in the New World, or in the West Atlantic, as we say now. But my research shows that that isn't so. And we have to realize that slaves and laborers are people, and people don't stop speaking their native or indigenous languages just because they arrive on a new shore. We can look here in the United States and see that that doesn't happen. So that the first generation that comes is likely to continue using the language, even as they using their own native language, even as they are beginning the first steps of learning the language or languages of their new host community.
Mm-hmm. What happened to the language when it comes to the idea of sustaining the native culture? How much did the language change, for example, as it found itself, or these languages as they found themselves on the shores of the New World, to helping these African peoples remember where it was they came from and the cultures that they had originated in?
Well, they maintained their language by, as I say, everyday use. They also maintained it in religious practices. Mm-hmm. They maintained it in songs because they needed songs for death. Occasions of death,
ceremonial functions
uh-huh. for marriages and so on. Those are some of the main areas, you know, the main domains in which they use their language. And but the language began to change, it would appear. Of course, we have no examples of those first generation Africans speaking their languages
because we had no
tape recorders and things like that.
You have the question of how far back the human memory can operate.
Yes, well, the people that I interviewed were anywhere between 60 years old and 103.
My goodness.
And so they were able to remember what their grandparents, or in some cases what their parents had, you know, and in some cases great-grandparents, uh-huh. what they had said. So that I am really working with the reproduction of African language texts as articulated by children or grandchildren.
Can you give me a couple of examples, Maureen Warner Lewis? For example, you have talked about Kikongo, Yoruba, Hausa, and Fon. Mm-hmm. Can you give me an example of a good morning, how are you, what's for dinner tonight? How does this work for you as a linguist? Is it all dry as dust and scholarly?
No. Well, there are lots of songs, and I'll probably try and sing a song or two for you. But say in Yoruba, good morning, they would say something like Okuo or Okaro, Ekuale, that's for good evening. Among the Kikongo, in Kikongo, they would say Kiambote or Mavimpi. For health, it's a wish of good health and uh-huh. things like that. So these were some of the things that they would exchange.
Can you give me a quick example of a song or a chant? Which language are you going to use?
All right, I'm gonna sing in Yoruba. I'm gonna sing a song that says, "If the world had gone, I would have done wonders in this world. If the world had been peaceful." I would have become a king, or I would have ridden a horse. We have to remember that at the time that a number of the Yoruba people came, the reason that they came was because the kingdom that they belonged to, the empire that they belonged to, had begun to disintegrate by the end of the 18th century. Hmm. It had begun to disintegrate because of civil war, internal political upheavals. So that, you know, that's, I think, the meaning of if the world had been peaceful, you know, I would have been much better off than I am now. And the song goes, Arambara e. Arambada de la ye, arambada he, arambada o, ibatoro ibajaba, ibatoro ibajaba, ibatoro ibajaba, ayebatoro bajashi. And then it continues again.
That's wonderful. Maureen, we're talking about your project, your scholarship on Caribbean and African language texts. How freighted, how rich are these literary traditions when, for example, if we compare them to the work of the dead white males, the people who are in trouble with the literary scholars in the United States and Canada and South America, how rich, as I say, would these literary traditions be in comparison to what we call the great literary texts?
Well, some of them may seem pretty trivial. Some of the material might seem pretty trivial. You know, they're really folk songs. A lot of them are folk songs. And folk songs tend to talk a lot about events that have happened in the neighborhood, in the community.
But that doesn't make them any less meaningful, does it?
No. It says a lot about, you know, about the sort of things that interested people, that the sort of events that got into the communal memory. But some of them, for instance, the ones on the songs on death, the dirges, are very interesting. They say a lot about the conception of death and of life. They're songs for marriage. They say something about the value of marriage. I have one Yoruba song that speaks of children without breasts having children, you know, obviously an indictment of someone in the community or some tendency, you know, to what would be regarded as sexual promiscuity in the community. So it tells you a lot about social values and so on. And then, of course, the religious texts are very interesting. The ones from Cuba are particularly rich, much richer, I think, than anything that I could collect in Trinidad.
For example, are we talking about the transmission of theological doctrines, or are we talking about the transmission of local beliefs? How big is the picture?
Well, for instance, in Cuba, they have retained a number of the myths and legends of the Yoruba gods and goddesses. The Yoruba are one of the groups in Africa, or the group in Africa, that has a large pantheon of deities, almost like a Greek pantheon, its equivalent. And each of these deities has a whole corpus of songs dedicated to that deity. And I've been able to collect lots of these in Trinidad. And in Cuba, they have even more. And apart from that, in Cuba, they have retained another corpus, a very important oral corpus of divination texts.
I remember that wonderful novel by, was it Charles Johnson, called Middle Passage, about these the middle passage of black people from Africa to the New World, and there is a Yoruban god on board this boat, and it's full of wonderful mysterious experiences.
Well, this is a very rich resource for the arts in the Caribbean. The Cubans have done a lot in their dance choreography with the movements from the Santeria or from the Orisha religion. In drama too, they use it. They've been using it in other parts of the Caribbean where these traditions are, you know, part of the oral, you know, bedrock. In Trinidad, we have been using it. Toni Morrison has been using the myth of the right, flying Africans and so on. So that these are part of our, just as the Greek legends, you know, have been used and exploited and mined by Western scholarship, Caribbean peoples of African descent and of non-African descent are able also and have been using these myths and legends.
Now, do you look at these things, Maureen Warner-Lewis, and do you impart to them because of what you see going on as a scholar? That is, you organize these materials. Do you impart to them the status of what we would call the literary canon? Is this really the basis for a literary inheritance, or is it fragmented? How do you bring it all together?
No, I teach literature, so I have an interest in, and I teach not only literature, African literature and West Indian literature, but I also teach oral literature, and I use some of my material.
What do you use for texts?
Yeah, I use some of my oral texts in my oral literature class, and I also see the once we are able to translate, as I and others have been working on the translation of these African oral texts, once we are able to translate them and understand what they are really saying, you know, and they understand the context, once it is possible, as I've been trying to do over two or three decades now to reconstruct the socio-cultural crucible or context out of which in which these oral texts operated, I think we stand a good chance of eventually getting this stuff included in our canon. So we understand, for instance, we need to incorporate the oral in our understanding of how West Indian Caribbean literature has developed.
Maureen Warner Lewis, we're talking about your scholarship on Caribbean African language texts. Could we have another example? This one is in Kikongo.
Yes, it is. And it elaborates our understanding of our history because it indicates that Africans were present in the British army that fought against the Boers at Majuba Hill.
This is the Boer War.
Boer War in 1881. And it would appear that there were black troops among the British who were eventually defeated by the Boers. And the song goes, Ezi mboz, mboze majuba, teling lezi mabode yekni mengama.
Now, is this useful to a historian? For example, once you get this translated, does it square with the facts, so to speak, or is it important simply as an artifact of oral culture?
No, I think that it helps to elaborate, as I said, our history, because I have been trying to find out whether or not there were black troops among the British. Huh. And it doesn't seem, from what I know up to now, that there has been any documentation of this black presence.
So here you have a very concrete example of a kind of cultural transmission from African shores to Caribbean shores.
And I have songs in Yoruba about wars which took place there. You know, they may not specify. In some cases, the particular places where the wars took place were specified. But all of these are sort of oral documentation. This is how the ordinary person saw the event.
Now, how important is the kind of thing that you study, Maureen Warner Lewis, to young people, let's generalize, in the Caribbean, African, North, South American world today? I mean, we live in the United States in a mass culture of MTV and McDonald's hamburgers. Are we really sort of holding on to something that is disappearing more quickly than we can recover it?
Well, it is disappearing. But you see, in the Caribbean, we are small islands. And we, because of the shame and disgrace, so to speak, of our coming to this region, there are many people who prefer not to think about slavery, who don't like to hear it spoken about and so on. Black people even, people, mulattoes and so on, generally. But we need to, a nation is never, or people are never confident, are never whole, can never really face up to other people unless they come to grips with what, you know, what, where their ancestors have come from.
So language becomes a form of national pride here.
Yes,
after a fashion.
Well, what I am doing is really filling in a gap in our cultural history that existed up to when I began to work on this in the early 1970s. I began to publish on it, and now people are aware that now people are aware of this continuing African presence, and that we are beginning to see our past and our slave experience and so on, not just as a monolith that happened over 300 or 400 years, but as something that went through various stages and phases, so that we begin to refine, I would say, our understanding of our history and the processes, of change and so on, through looking at language and cultural retentions and things like that.
Maureen Warner Lewis, let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation. In what ways does your scholarship go to the whole knotty problem of multiculturalism? Are we the same? Are we different? Can we understand one another? That kind of thing.
I think that we can understand each other, and I think that we must. We have been put on this planet together, and, you know, it really hurts me when I hear, you know, events coming out of whether Rwanda or Sri Lanka or Bosnia or wherever. We have to really consider very seriously the implications, the upheaval, the personal and national upheavals that take place when people exercise hatred and spite against each other, maybe on very flimsy basis. I think the more I study, I do believe in multiculturalism, and the more I study and read, the more I realize that human beings are essentially the same. The surface manifestations of their cultural practices may differ, but essentially, we are all dealing with birth and death and trying to succeed and trying to be comfortable in our lives and so on. And I think I like what I do because it brings me over and over again to that realization of the oneness of humanity. But I think that it is necessary, in order to feel that oneness, one must understand where one stands in the whole shingbang.
In the whole what? In the whole shebang.
Shebang, yes.
I wondered if that was an African word or the jargon that I thought I recognized there.
Yes, you know. In other words, each person has got to stand up tall, stand up strong, in order to be counted and to feel themselves comfortable in the community of man.
Maureen Warner Lewis teaches at the University of the West Indies. During her recent fellowship at the National Humanities Center, she worked on a study of Caribbean African language texts. Her new book, tentatively entitled From Mother Tongue to Memory, is a study of the Yoruba language in Trinidad. From Mother Tongue to Memory is scheduled for publication by the University of Alabama Press. Stay tuned for information about writing for an audio cassette of this program. You're listening to Soundings, a magazine of ideas and insights from the National Humanities Center. I'm Wayne Pond. For an audio cassette of this discussion, send $10 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code is 27709. Please ask for program number 724. That's program number 724. The National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip code again is 27709. Next week on Soundings, the life and letters of Southern playwright Paul Green. My guest will be Lawrence Avery, a professor of English at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Lawrence Avery will be here to read from and talk about his new book, A Southern Life, The Letters of Paul Green. Thanks for listening to Soundings. Our theme music is by Jeff Perry. Partial support for this program came from Carolina Power and Light, where listening generates powerful ideas. Soundings is a cultural affairs service of the National Humanities Center.